My name is Ted Kavrikoff, and I'm here on behalf of William Ryan Barnes. I also represented him in the court below. The number one issue here, well, maybe not number one, but one of the main issues is the fact that...
Did you want to save any time for rebuttal?
Oh, I'll save about 3 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Is that he could not remember anything. He could not remember ordinary and simple things. And then the question becomes what one should do in a situation like that. He, as my briefs and the transcript indicate, he was really unable to testify. He could not even say his address. He had difficulty saying his name. He had difficulty articulating anything at all.
Typically, though, counsel, when individuals are suffering from some sort of disability, and I guess that's the best way to describe your client's circumstances, was that he was suffering from some sort of disability. Aren't there ways or mechanisms to allow critical evidence to be presented to the trial court? Obviously, there are exceptions to the hearsay rule when someone is unavailable, and if the individual was acting under a disability, then a reasonable argument could have been made that he was indeed unavailable to testify, and you might be able to have gotten the evidence in through some sort of other mechanism.
Well, I had thought about it, but I really could not at the time think of another way of presenting this evidence, if this evidence was necessary. I had his final divorce decree. There was nothing about, and that divorce decree about exactly what his income was and what were the basis for deciding spousal support at $1,200 a month.
Didn't we have his former partner present who testified?
Yes, I did. Well, it was not a former partner at that time, Your Honor. He was simply a person who was working for Mr. Barnes, and I don't know if they kept records that far back. We're talking about minimum of 22 years ago, and this company changed names. Mr. Barnes retired back in...
How about the possibility of, say, going back and getting tax returns? I know the IRS isn't the most cooperative agency under the sun, but if you write to the IRS and say, I need my client's tax returns and W-4s for the years such and such, such and such, such and such, I'm sure that that might have been one means or mechanism to actually get the information.
Well, there may be possibilities of doing that, but I thought at the time, after reviewing a number of cases, mm-hmm. was that the court must look at the present circumstances, what the present circumstances were, and not going way back 22 years. And basically, there are a number of cases which, and I'll cite it to you, simply say this: the spousal support awards must be determined in light of contemporary circumstances and redetermined, if necessary, in light of new circumstances. Well, that's what we had. We had new circumstances. And the case are blank v. blank, fur v. fur, bars v. bars. And even the Moreno case also cites blank for that proposition. And then we have a Supreme Court case, Jacobs v. Jacobs, which basically says the same thing.
I think those cases, as you quite correctly point out, outline the process for going through a case such as this. In other words, where someone is coming in and arguing a material change of circumstances justifying a change to the spouse support amount. I think those cases set out the formula for doing it, but they don't really talk about the necessity to put on appropriate proof to justify your position in a case such as that. I look at this case, and I might be wrong, but I look at this case as an evidence case rather than a case involving whether or not the right procedure was used to calculate whether or not there was a change in circumstance.
Well, the difficulty in this case also was that Mr. Barnes was living in North Carolina. Last time I saw him, when he came here to this area to interview him, he seemed to be capable of at least answering some simple questions. And I had talked to him about what he was making before. He was not sure. I left it at that. So if when I believed that what we have is that it could be redetermined on the present circumstances without going back, without seeing what was happening 22 years ago, that will be sufficient. So, and that's when I read all these cases, that's what the conclusion that I came to, that if I show what the present circumstances are, and I did, we've had a lot of evidence on that, then the court can decide what the spousal support should be at this moment, at the moment of trial, and not what it was and did it is and should it be changed now.
But to establish a material change of circumstances, doesn't the fact finder have to know what the original circumstances were?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, no. There are numbers of a number of cases where the change of circumstances or something else besides financial changes. For example, in domestic relations, somebody got divorced 5 years later, and spousal support or child support or whatever was established. And then 5 years later, that person went and got married. So the marriage itself means that or is used as changed circumstances. So that's not necessarily the same. Another example may be that
I don't think the marriage would suggest a change circumstances. Some additional children might change the circumstances,
right.
i.e. if you had child support obligation for two children, you remarried and you had another child, that might well impact the child support guidelines, thus constituting a change of circumstances. But as I recall those cases from a proof standpoint, you would come in with the order from the prior child support determination and say, Judge, in 2000, you entered an order saying my client should pay $500 a month in child support, and it was for child A and child B. Your Honor, I'm reporting to the court that I'm putting on evidence that my client is now married. He's had a child with his new wife, and the child's name is Susie, and now there's a support obligation associated with Susie, so now my client's obligation does not relate to two children, it now relates to three children, so therefore that's the material change of circumstance I'm talking about.
Well, that is absolutely true, Your Honor, but speaking of changed circumstances, he retired, and when he retired, that's a changed circumstance. Then what happened next is that after retirement, he sold his 40% shares in that company to three other people. So and they were supposed to pay monthly, or they were paying him monthly payments, then those payments stopped in December of 2011. So when they stopped, that's another circumstance. He's no longer getting that income that he was getting. He's relying on Social Security now and some small annuities. So that's another change of circumstances. So when you go and talk about change circumstances, there is always something which does not mean that you gotta go 22 years ago. Also passage of time. What was decided 22 years ago, there is a lot of time passed since that time.
The term circumstance in and of itself is defined as relating back to some prior event. That's what a circumstance is, something in the past. And if there's no baseline or basis for knowing what the prior events were, how can a judge decide whether or not there is a change in what the prior events were?
Well, ultimately, sir, if you can just tell us exactly, Judge Alston is, you've got some changes in circumstances, but those don't necessarily trigger any type of reduction in child support and or spousal support. course, we're talking about spousal here, but ultimately, how can we ever, and how could the trial judge ever determine that your client, even though he may have dementia now and have some reduced circumstances, how could that judge ever know that there was not waste that occurred between the time that the order was entered and that you now appear before the court? Because your client, of course, is not entitled to spend his money freely without consideration of his responsibility to his former spouse once there's a court order down. So that's really the reason, and that's why you need to address and present evidence in reference to that, so the court can determine from a baseline what's happened till now, and perhaps there was no waste. I don't know. We don't know because we don't have a record of any evidence that was issued in reference to that. So that leaves the judge unable, as I think the judge stated, to consider the remedy that you're requesting. And of course, we're in the same position.
Well, if the judge would consider the current circumstances, and he can rule on that, because the judge knows what my client is making at the present time, the Social Security and annuities, and then he can find out what the other party is, his income is, and then go and figure it out. So the way I read those cases again is that they are talking about redetermining, and redetermining means that you have it, it's the evidence, and it's redetermined. Well, let me go to the next issue, if I may. The next issue is the judicial notice. There was a motion for reconsideration which I filed, and then on the judge granted hearing on that. And during this hearing, I asked the judge to take judicial notice of what his income was, which, as I knew and I mentioned in opening statement, is that it was in the Court of Appeals of this court, had the case had gone originally at the time of divorce to the Court of Appeals.
But no copy of that case decision was tendered to the court or tendered into evidence, was it?
He did not want to get it, Your Honor, and also it was in the file. I myself saw it in the file, and that's where I get the figures which I mentioned.
But you did not have a certified copy of that made and present it into evidence?
I asked to present a copy. The judge declined to get it. That was not at the original hearing. That was at the motion for reconsideration. And then what is happening is that we have all those rules, starting with Rule 2.21B, which simply states that judicial notice may be taken at any stage of the proceeding. I ask him to go and take judicial notice of the proceedings.
But aren't you required to actually physically tender a copy of the pleading that you want offered into evidence?
It's no requirement that he be done. If I am telling him it is the opinion from the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals states exactly what the amount is, since you're talking about what was the income of the client at that time, that 22 years ago.
And I appreciate what you're saying, but the danger in that is there could be all kinds of considerations associated with a court opinion from the Court of Appeals. There may have been issues waived. There may have been evidentiary problems at the presentation of the case when it was heard earlier. There could have been all kinds of variables, and just to sort of pick numbers out of an opinion, which was not offered during the course of the trial, to form the basis of a changed circumstances. Are there any cases that you can cite for that proposition?
No, but the rules are very clear.
Yes, sir.
And there are no cases actually on this point. The rules are very clear. All you gotta do is tell them where to go and take a look at and take judicial notice. I also mentioned that opinion counsel and I did mention that opinion at the very beginning of the case, where we said that, yeah, there was an opinion from the Court of Appeals, and then the judge asked, well, what actually happened? And the opinion was sitting right there all the time.
Counsel, your time has actually expired, as has your rebuttal time. What I'm going to do is hear from your opponent colleague, and I'll give you 1 minute in rebuttal extra time.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Susan Leslie Frazier, and I'm very pleased being before the appeals for the second time in a year. Let's hope this one doesn't turn out like the last one did. The reason that I am here this morning is to argue about evidence, and this is the heart and soul of this case. The question is, and it's a fascinating question, because every single one, without fail, every single decision regarding a motion to modify spousal support decided either by this court or the Virginia Supreme Court goes into a recitation of what the facts were at the original hearing, the trial court's decision. And there's a reason for this, which is kind of significant and goes back to my favorite professor from Washington and Lee, Professor Graves, who actually wrote the book on a lot of civil procedure things. And what he said is, do not ever forget the issue of res judicata. Res judicata is the reason why we don't go back and retry a case.
Mr. Kavakoff is suggesting to us, and then I think that there is a record to support it, that due to the circumstances presented, his client's limitations, and I don't think, and I appreciate you being an officer of the court and your candor, that his client was very limited because of the disease that he was suffering and was essentially unable to testify, that he, in effect, had no ability to establish the changed circumstances because he couldn't establish, in the term you used in your brief, the baseline for what the circumstances are, and that essentially it's unfair that just because his client is limited, he can't present the current circumstances justifying a reduction in the support.
And Your Honor, had I been in his situation, I would have done one of three things. First of all, I would have gotten a copy from the Fairfax County Circuit Court archives, where they store all prior cases that are older than 5 years. It takes a while, it takes 3 weeks to get that copy. I know, because I had one sitting in my evidence box, had I gone ahead and put on my case attacking their case. But we didn't get to that point. The burden of proof is on the moving party. Mr. Kavakoff could have done exactly what I did, which is file that request for the original.
So you actually had it?
Yes, sir, I did. It was in my evidence box, sitting right behind me. And in terms of that, the relevance of this is also that even had that not been available, if let's say this wasn't a case that had gone up to the Court of Appeals, both of the attorneys who represented each of the parties at the divorce were still alive. Both of them could have come in and supplied copies of their exhibits if those exhibits had in fact been destroyed. If there was no report of the decision, if it had just simply said for the reasons announced in open court, I hereby find as follows. But that's not what Judge Annunziata did. She went through in her final decree and outlined all of the points under 2107.1. She talked about everything. With all due respect to opposing counsel, what he has represented to this court is not what was in my evidence box. And the problem, as Your Honor has indicated, is you can't use the Court of Appeals decision because, as you said, there may be issues that were not addressed in that which were addressed at the trial court. So in terms of being able to prove this, there were three different ways to prove it. The fourth way, as Your Honor has indicated, is that gentleman from his company, now the president, could have gone back and easily submitted evidence from his corporation. If they didn't have it, they could have gone ahead and given an indication as to what their records generally reflected. And also, as you indicated, they could have gone to the IRS and said, what did the tax returns say? And that was another thing, because I had a copy of the 1990 tax return also in my evidence box that I did not put on, because it wasn't my burden of proof. This is the central question, and this is perhaps the toughest part of this. When you look at the statute, under Section A, which is the statutory section for 2109 that focuses specifically on the issue of a litigated spousal support award, as opposed to a negotiated one by property settlement agreement, it does in fact say material change in circumstances and based on the current circumstances. And it doesn't say specifically you must go back. Interestingly enough, in subsection B, it does in fact indicate that you must go back. Is that an indication by the legislature that the legislature intended for us to have two different standards of proof between a litigated and a non-litigated case? There is not a single case in Virginia that stands for that proposition. And so I think it's extremely important to look at this because of what we're looking at is, and yes, people have all sorts of changes in their lives, but perhaps most importantly, what the Schoenwetter case decided is that you must be able to talk about the impact on the ability to pay of the payor. If you fail to do that, then you have no basis on which to go ahead and say, oh, well, we've had all these terrible changes. And that's the point. The elephant in the room, if you will, for me, is this man was paid by his evidence $500,000. And I emphasize that, $500,000. And yet 4 years later, he's standing there pulling out his pockets and saying, look, I have nothing. But that wasn't true. And let's assume for the moment that we had gotten past the motion to strike, and we had gone ahead, and we had gone to this question of the equities between the parties. One of the things that this court and the entire court system in Virginia on the issue of spousal support has never done is we have never honored wastrels. We've never honored spendthrifts. We've never honored people who choose to fritter away their earnings. And one of the essential questions here is were this court to decide that because he blew through $500,000 in 4 years, now we should pat him on the head and say, oh yes, that's fine. I don't think that's what the law holds. We don't award people's behaviors when they it's self-inflicted. So whether it's an actual neglect on his part, and again, there was no evidence to any of this, but in terms of what we have and in terms of the evidence, one of the essential questions is, what do we have as the baseline? And the Rogers versus Rogers case is the one that I found that is closest to this question. This was the case where the gentleman who was in the building trade, there was a final decree of divorce in 2005, and then he came back in 2007 and said, I've had a material change in circumstances. And the judge said, I can't let you do this because I don't know what our baseline was. Although that's not the judge's words, that's the term I'm choosing to use. And in that particular case, what he did show to the trial court, which was clearly before the trial court, was his prior monthly expenses. And the trial court found from his expenses and his income and ruled that his income was $6,000. And at the time of the motion to modify, the court said, well, I can't tell what those expenses were. And yes, you can. It's a pretty simple aspect of math. 9,000 minus 6,000 is 3,000. So the court could have inferred that fact from the trial court's original decision. And in fact, that's why this court reversed the trial court and said, no, you've got to take it back. You've got to look at this because that is a material change in circumstances because of, not because of bad behavior by this man, but because in fact his industry, the entire housing industry, had gone belly up in 2007. And so this man had no income coming, not because he was bad, not because he was a wastrel, but because in fact his whole industry died, or pretty much died. Now it's back. But the happy thought for us in terms of this case is it really is a res judicata issue. And the reason I say this is because, unlike any other final decision, we allow our courts in divorce matters to come back and look at the issue of spousal support when it has been litigated under 2109A or under 2109B when we have a material change in circumstances, including a number of things such as the children issue that Your Honor, Judge Alston, indicated. So one of the questions then becomes, all right, so who has to do this? And of course, it's my opponent's position that the judge should have done this. Well, that's not how we do evidence in Virginia. Never has been, never will be. Occasionally we'll get a kind trial judge, especially for new lawyers, who will take them by the hand and sort of say, this is what you need to put on. But Mr. Kavrikov, as the court can clearly see, is as old as I am. And I've been doing this for 32 years. So therefore, based on that, he should have known what the evidentiary standard was. And the evidentiary standard is to go ahead and prove this. If you go back and you look at the actual argument of the case, and this is another important point which I think is significant as well, motions to strike are generally not encouraged. Why? Because it does in fact truncate the entire process. And quite often, you know, there's a litany going all the way back to the 1950s, certainly, and you know, the massive tome on civil procedure. And
motions to strike are not favored based upon the premise that we want to allow people to have their day in court.
Yes, sir.
And in this case, Mr. Kavrikov would suggest that because of the limitations of his client, he was unable to have his day in court, and that certain accommodations, I guess, for lack of a better word, should have been available to his client because of those circumstances.
Yes, but one of the most important things in this matter is that this wasn't the first time up on this case. In this particular case, Mr. Kavrikov filed his original motion to modify in January of 2012. That went to trial in September of 2012. Mr. Kavrikov non-suited, as he is allowed to do, because he had evidentiary issues at that time. So one would think that those should have been cured the second time up. Now, in terms of the order of non-suit, it doesn't go into why, it just simply says he non-suited, and that did not form a part of the record. But I think it's particularly important to notice that when you have already been up one time and you non-suit during the course of the trial, it's usually an indication something's gone wrong. And in terms of evidence, he could have taken the time then, because he had 6 months under the non-suit statute, to go ahead and track down the former attorneys to get those certified true copies of Judge Annunziata's original decision from the trial court, because I certainly had them. And he also could have gotten the paper copies of the opinion by the Court of Appeals, because that does in fact talk about some of the evidence with regard to incomes, et cetera. Although the primary focus of Barnes v. Barnes 1 in the Court of Appeals is in fact on the question of payment of spousal support in a post-separation adultery case, and whether or not it was manifest injustice. And of course, that's what Judge Annunziata's opinion originally issued spent a great deal of time talking about. And so, you know, when we look at this kind of situation, again, look at what it was that opposing counsel argued. And if you can compare the original motion that he filed in January of 2012 to the motion that he refiled after the non-suit in September of 2012, what you suddenly see is that he took out some language. And he focused on solely, not the financial changes, but instead he focused on other things. One of the things that Mr. Kavrikov tried to argue to the court at the motion for reconsideration was the fact that, you know, he could give the judge that now. And there was no explanation why he couldn't have given that Court of Appeals decision to the judge at either Barnes 1, tried and then ended in September of 2012, or at the May hearing in 2013. And this is an evidentiary failure. And the importance of this is significant, because when we look at the question of why we allow this to happen and why it's acceptable for the court to go ahead and take a second look at what has been a decision, is because of the ongoing fluid nature of spousal support, particularly in cases where it's not a time-limited award. And that decision by our legislature that our courts have consistently maintained, it is a right of the parties to go back, but the burden of proof is on the moving party for that modification. Opposing counsel's suggestion that the issue about remarriage by itself is an indication of a material change in circumstances, that is not the statute. That is the statute that talks about the absolute decision by the Virginia legislature to say that there shall be no spousal support payable to somebody who has remarried. Why? Because now the person receiving spousal support is somebody else's burden, not the original spouse. And the reason for that is because why should an old spouse have to keep paying for someone who has now stepped into that matrimonial fiction, as we call it, of the two shall be one, in all ways, and particularly finances. So therefore,
going to church.
It's a separate statute, and it has nothing what to do with 2109A. And I think that that is equally significant. The other point is, in terms of where the court's actual physical location is of that file. Every circuit court is different, but Fairfax, being one of the largest courts in our state, has to manage its files. And the way they do this is they have a container system not on the premises of what I often refer to as the Fairfax Judicial Palace. It's not kept there, not after 5 years. And you have to go through. But there are published notices all over the courthouse that say, if you need a file older than 5 years, go talk to the records room clerk. So it's a matter of public notice there, certainly in terms of that. Finally, on the issue of judicial notice, the problem that I have with opposing counsel's position is this. Judicial notice is of a published event. And perhaps the most clear example that we have of this, as Your Honor, Judge Huff said, is well, why does the judge have to bring this in? Whose burden of proof is that? Anytime that I take in any sort of case law, and I've had judges look at me and say, well, counsel, what's your authority for that? And I'll go, I didn't bring that with me. And I've had a judge look at me and say, well, then guess what? If you can't cite me to the proper authority, it's not my job. And it was Mr. Kavanaugh's job, and he failed in that. So therefore, the decision of the Fairfax County Circuit Court to grant the motion to strike, to deny the motion for reconsideration, was appropriate. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kavanaugh, give you 5 minutes.
Well, all this speculation, I could have done this, I could have done that. Well, I read it. I read the cases, and I decided to do it differently. But going back to the judicial notice, first of all, any official document or publication can be used. This is in the rule. And then the court shall take judicial notice of the contents of all official publication of the Commonwealth. And of course, the publication of this court are official documents. After I brought to the attention of the judge that situation, he did not do anything.
The statute from which you quoted, 801-389A, the record of any judicial proceeding, et cetera, shall be received as prima facie evidence, goes on to say, provided that such records are authenticated and certified by the clerk of the court. Had you done any of that?
No, I have not.
Okay.
No, I just relied on the fact that this document, this opinion, was in the court file. And the judge could very easily read it, and he simply did not want to hear it. His ruling was he should have presented this at the original hearing, not at the motion for reconsideration. But as I mentioned previously, it could be in any stage of the proceedings, and definitely motion for reconsideration is a proceeding of the case. I don't have much time. I would like to also mention that if all else fails, then I'll ask the court to also address or consider Rule 5A18, of course, which I believe is appropriate in this case. And that the rule, of course, it has provides for exception for good cause or to meet the ends of justice. And under the circumstances here, ends of justice were not met, and they should. And I would ask the court to remand this case back so we can have another hearing.
Okay. Thank you. The matter has been submitted. We'll come down and greet counsel.